Welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. This is Eric Loomis, and I am here today with Jared Roll, who is an associate professor of history at the University of Mississippi. He is the author of Spirit of Rebellion, Labor and Religion in the New Cotton South. It was published by the University of Illinois Press in 2010. The co-author with Eric Gelman of The Gospel of the Working Class, Labor's Southern Prophets in New Deal America. It was published by the University of Illinois Press in 2011. And we are here today to discuss his new book, Poor Man's Fortune, White Working Class Conservatism in American Metal Mining, 1850 to 1950, that was published this spring by the University of North Carolina Press. Jared, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, Eric. It's a pleasure.
Yeah. Would you just start by describing your book to our listeners?
Yeah. Well, Poor Man's Fortune is a fine-grained grassroots history of the miners of the tri-state zinc and lead mining district from the 1850s to the 1950s. This is a mining district that was a significant producer of lead, but also in the 1920s, the nation's largest supplier of zinc, supplied 70% of U.S. zinc. And so it's notable for those reasons. But what I'm interested in this book is the history of its miners, who for most of that history resisted, outright rejected labor unions. They didn't join them. But they also actively took advantage of strike-breaking opportunities to fight them for profit, particularly the Western Federation of Miners from the 1890s to the 19-teens. They also rejected union-backed calls for health and safety laws, health and safety measures in the mines, even though they were suffering some of the worst rates of silicosis and tuberculosis in the United States at the time. And so what I wanted to do was set out and try to explain these miners on their own terms, using the tools and methods of bottom-up labor history, and really rejecting interpretations that rely on top-down explanations, whether that's company coercion, powerlessness, or just the fear, even ignorance of the miners themselves. Throughout this period, they had access to alternative ideas. Various unions came through the district trying to organize them, particularly after they started strike breaking. And the majority of the miners rejected them each and every time. And so I wanted to understand the world, their world from their perspective, and examine through close analysis of sources to try to get a glimpse into their mind over that period.
And when you talk about the tri-state area, for our listeners, which three states are we talking about here?
Sure, sorry. Tri-state district is where Oklahoma, Kansas, and Missouri come together. It's a five-county district that straddles that boundary, kind of on the western slopes of the Ozarks, where the Ozarks flatten out into the Great Plains.
And so, you know, this is an area where obviously you have a lot of white working class conservatism today. And I think that, you know, one of the things I really loved about your book is the ability to sort of gain more context into the minds, obviously, of people who were, anti-union and not really uniting economically, you know, for their what outsiders might perceive of as their own interests 100 years ago or 60 years ago or 70 years ago, I guess, but also today, and the kind of ways in this works today. And so I guess the question that I might start with is why are these workers so conservative? What is it that makes them so anti-union, despite, as you say, their very poor health and safety records and all of this?
Well, it's a combination of things that interlock and that have a deep history that goes back to the founding of the district in the 1850s. And those things are deep investment in ideas of white supremacy, a practice of reckless risk-taking masculinity, but crucially, a deep-seated belief in the promises of capitalism. Capitalism for poor but hardworking white men. A promise of prosperity for these people that goes all the way back to the conditions of the founding of the district, the way that state power was used to expel Native Americans, was used to facilitate their access to these mining claims and exploit what are fairly peculiar geological conditions in the district. Shallow, fragmented deposits that privileged small mining companies who could work with very little capital to become truly owner-operator miners and small concerns, fully invested in Trans-Mississippi West metal markets in the middle of the 19th century, and in many ways created a zinc market in the late 19th century. But to me, it's the bedrock is essentially the privilege of whiteness, of white American citizens, and the application of an aggressive idea of masculinity to in pursuit of and in deep belief of the promises of capitalism, that those three things explain what for them provides an explanatory model for these miners that allows them to see a future of prosperity, even when that prosperity is not to hand or not easily seen, and becomes a tradition that is reproduced socially from one generation to the next, that generated an expectation in new generations that they would have the same opportunities as the generation that came before them.
I want to kind of explore each of these ideas a little bit, in a little bit more depth. One of the striking things to me is that as labor historians, and I think that, you know, in the kind of activist world generally, we have this sort of vision of the American working class as being fundamentally pro-union, that there's, you know, these moments of Pullman and Homestead and Ludlow and all of these famous moments of labor resistance and resistance to capitalism, and that, you know, this kind of comes to fruition in the New Deal and then after, and has declined, you know, in recent decades. And, you know, your work, I think, very usefully kind of pushes against this somewhat pat narrative. And so I think in terms of, I guess, to start with race, I mean, what makes these workers in metal mining different than, say, the Western Federation of Miners or the other kinds of mine workers that, you know, had more of a union background or had more successful unionism?
In the West, miners who created and joined the Western Federation of Miners were very quickly sucked up into large, very large, intense factory-like mines that were very deep, that were isolated in company towns and generally dominated by a single company or a couple of big companies. So they're very quickly thrust into the most extreme forms of late 19th century industrial capitalism that very quickly disrupts any kind of idea that they might have that they could become an owner-operator of their own account. There are miners like that in the West in the 1860s and 1870s. There's small-scale mining. There's some owner-operator mining. There's piecework organization to many of the mines that gives small companies a working stake in the profitability of the mine. Whereas in the tri-state district, first Southwest Missouri, then Southeast Kansas, then to a much lesser extent, Oklahoma, miners that transition to intense industrial capitalist production is much slower and much more gradual, so that you get a 50-year period where the vast majority of mines are run by owner-operator companies or companies that are employing 10 to 15 employees where the owner used to be a working miner, but has now maybe expanded operations a bit. And there are hundreds of these companies. By 1900, there are about 500 mining companies in a five-county district, each working very modest operations. And compared to, say, Butte, Montana, or Cripple Creek, Colorado, these are rudimentary, what seem like primitive operations. So the transition is stalled, which allows these ideas of poor man's prosperity. The district becomes known, becomes famous as a poor man's camp, where poor men can come in without capital, and by breaking their back and working themselves to death can develop capital. That's much more drawn out. That allows those ideas to take root, to seem achievable in ways that are just in some ways extreme in terms of late 19th century economic production, but I don't think exceptional. I think speak to a wider range of occupations and working class experiences, particularly in rural areas or small towns, where working class men in particular can imagine themselves becoming owners, owner operators, and really believing in an entrepreneurial idea of what they're doing, what their aims are. So I don't think that it's not that the stories about, like, you know, Pullman the other kind of big flashpoints of the 19th century are untrue, but I don't think that they capture the full picture of what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, when I think about U.S. working class in, say, 1850, when you start your book, or it's really through much of the 19th century, it always has seemed to me that there's a deep belief that capitalism should be working for us. That it's a positive system, and this is maybe something has kind of gone awry, but it really it ultimately this is a system that should benefit us, and that. You don't really necessarily see a lot of really sophisticated challenges to that until you are in areas of widespread immigration and the kind of ideas that are coming over from Europe. And so I guess, my assumption from reading your book is that most of these miners are native-born Americans who come from the general, if not tri-state area, at least that part of the country. Am I correct about that? And if I am, how does that matter in terms of understanding understanding, the history of white working class?
Yeah. At first, at first the miners come from somewhere else to take over land that's been taken from Native Americans. But, they come from the upper Mississippi Valley lead industry in the 1850s and 1860s, the eastern Missouri lead industry. But then after the 1870s are coming from the wider regions surrounding farms. By the 1890s, 95% of them are native-born whites. They speak English. This creates a sense of social connection with those who become owners and those who do benefit from this poor man's system. So it becomes easier to imagine one rising from entry-level wage-working miner to owner-operator miner, because the owner-operators around you look like you, sound like you. It's easier to, gain access to credit, gain access to land, to negotiate opportunities, and also harder, I think, to break into that social or to risk rupturing those social connections by organizing in a union, to step back and say, no, my interests are different from your interests, when everything about the way the district is set up socially, economically, says our interests are the same. Those who are, working now can be owner operators later. That is convincing based on what actually happened, but also when it's not actually happening, is convincing in another way, that they see evidence of it all around them, right? And so I think that makes organizing harder, or organizing with an outside union harder, particularly when that union is majority foreign born, like the Western Federation of Miners by the early 20th century.
What about, how does their conception of their white identity impact this history?
So in the first 20 to 30 years, there's very little mention of their whiteness. Its power is certainly there because that's the reason they're there. Both taking Native American land, but also, able to resettle that land after the Civil War, which was particularly harsh in Southwest Missouri. But over time, their sense of racial identity becomes a way for them to explain their perceived advantages as miners, not just in the tri-state district, but elsewhere, particularly when they learn to market themselves as strike breakers throughout the West in the 1890s, first at Leadville, Colorado, against the Western Federation of Miners. The connections that they had made between their bosses based on race, nativity, language in the tri-state, they also kind of make those connections to the owners of much bigger companies in the West. And they see an advantage to being white, native-born workers who are non-union, who are going to go work in Colorado or Idaho or Washington and be loyal to companies there and help them break strikes launched by the foreign radicals in the Western Federation of Miners. And so it's through that process that they start to see whiteness as its own kind of capital, right? Its own kind of power mechanism, right? That they then bring back to the tri-state district that helps them reimagine wage labor as an entrepreneurial act after the owner-operator period finally goes away at about 1900 and the mines are too big and the only reality is really wage labor. They make claims on that labor and on their employers based on the color of their skin and nativity and on nationalism.
Yeah, because I'm glad you brought up the strike breaking too. I was going to ask about that because it's one thing to be, indifferent to unions or hostile to unions. It's a whole other thing to actively be strike breakers and to travel the country as strike breakers in a very intentional way, right? Unlike kind of classic story of, the coal mine in West Virginia bringing up African Americans from Alabama and not really telling them that they're going to be breaking a strike. These workers know that they're going to be breaking a strike. So, I mean, what is it that makes them so to take that next step beyond just hostility into open warfare against unions?
Well, so, they're not only going to strike zones knowing they're going as strike breakers, but they're negotiating wages, access to the jobs in case a deal gets reached with the union, cost of transportation, cost of board before they go. So in an odd way, they negotiate kind of like a union, but in the act of going to crush a union like mercenaries. I think that's maybe a more apt description, is that they're negotiating like mercenaries. I really interpret that as an extension of this older entrepreneurial mindset that's rooted in the earlier prospecting poor man's camp, where the whole thing is an economic gamble. Digging a hole in the ground to try to find paying metal to put on flatboats to sell in St. Louis is a gamble. Getting on a train to go to Leadville when they're telling you there's a good chance you might get shot is a gamble. That strike breaking becomes a way of navigating that transition from owner operator with smaller scale system to a larger scale system based on permanent wage labor.
And one thing that you brought up before, but you're starting to hint at again, is the idea of this of the masculinity of these miners and their gender identity. And can you add some of that to the story?
Yeah. So really to the 1890s, the dominant mode of masculinity is much like it is elsewhere, based on kind of respectability, certain kind of sobriety, certain manly code of fair dealings, at least with other white men, that kind of governs this fairly democratic, again, within the racial and gender limits of it, and allows for these hundreds of mining companies to work in side by side with fairly little friction between one another. But as that system breaks down and the companies become more intensified, and you see the route from wage labor to owner operator cut off, I see assertions of masculinity, ideas of masculinity becoming rougher, harsher, more reckless, more about less about financial risk of trying to sell metal on open markets, to more about individual physical risk to get the most money you can out of this piece rate system that develops for shoveling ore, because these are still fairly low capital mines. They don't have a lot of machinery, so operators pay miners to shovel ore by the canful, and miners turn this into a new entrepreneurial realm where they're both devising strategies to expand their production, but also reveling in the physicality of the production. So that by 1910 or 1915, some of the best shovelers are shoveling 100 tons a day. That very quickly kills them because you can't do that for very long. But to me, I find clear connections with that new form of rough masculinity as a way to literally turn your body into capital and as an entrepreneurial enterprise of destroying it, rooted in that older poor man's camp model.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you a little bit more about the health and safety conditions, which as you go into are horrible, and the ways in which, I guess you kind of already answered this, but in the ways in which these workers explain away or justify the fact that, they're getting sick and they're dying, and yet even this, the actual fact of death doesn't really change their position in terms of collective action.
It's really stunning to see this evidence laid out year after year. The mines are dusty. The conglomerate chert that a lot of this zinc is in is silica rich. And so when you're blasting this, it's just releasing plumes of minute diamond-like silica into the air that they're just sucking in. If you can imagine being in a hole, shoveling 100 tons of rock a day, what your breathing would be like, how much air you got to move through your lungs, just shreds their lungs. One study finds 60% of miners with silicosis in 1915, which gives them about 8 to 10 years left to live. And so unions come in elsewhere in Missouri, but also the Western Federation of Miner comes in. They advocate for ventilation shafts. They advocate for wearing masks, ventilators. They advocate for wetting down the ore piles. But all of these things are rejected by the miners because they slow down their work. They make it harder for them to deliver the same results on the piece rate, to make $5-7 a day on the piece rate that the best shovelers do. But it also restrains their masculine exertions, right? So it's not like it's killing them as entrepreneurs, but it's also reining them in as men. And so then but to not do that's also killing them. Yeah. They opt for risk. They opt for money. They opt for masculine power. And people in these towns are afraid of them, right? They gain this status as these supermen, and they're white men. And so in this age of Teddy Roosevelt and, rugged individualism, the strenuous life, they embody it. Their bosses are afraid of them. Middle-class people are afraid of them. And so they gain this kind of defiant power that they use then to trying to jack up piece rates for themselves to profit from. But when unions come in and try to organize them, and which means reining in those dynamics, they reject that. The majority do. I mean, there's always a minority who see sense and say, you know what? The Western Federation of Miners is right. We're going to join with them. We're going to try to change everybody's mind. And they fail until the 1930s, till the Great Depression sort of forces change.
You know, it's funny that you bring up people wearing, you know, refusing to wear masks because it's a, you know, it's an attack on their masculine identity, which is a little telling in the age where you're, you know, in response to COVID, you're seeing in some ways the exact same thing, right? White men especially refusing to wear masks because of X, Y, and Z. And in the, you know, we only have a few minutes left, but I wanted to kind of close with two additional questions that kind of bring us a little bit closer to the present. One is that, I know your book stopped in 1950, but you know, one of the narratives about American labor history is that, you know, at the end of World War II, the CIO engaged in Operation Dixie to attempt to organize the South, knowing that if they're unable to organize the South, they're not really going to succeed long term as a union heavy country. And they failed to do so for a variety of reasons. But in fact, that they're right, that the inability to organize the South means that the U.S. does not maintain a strong union presence, which is the scenario that we see today. And so can you sort of place your work and the lessons that we should be taking about large sectors of the white working class and think about sort of the failure of unionism in this country, you know, and today, of course, we have the lowest level of unionism, but, you know, especially the private sector, almost ever. So I was wondering if you would care to comment on the kind of post-war decline of unions in the context of your book.
Yeah, so I guess I would start by saying the book ends in 1950. I'm a committed historian. Like, a lot happens between 1950 and today, right? So I'm well aware of the limitations of the argument here, but what I would say is that I'm arguing for us understanding that the locus of white working class conservatism is outside of the labor movement, right? It's not on the right wing of the labor movement, that there's a whole other realm to the right of that. That's actually the majority of workers, even in the high point of labor union density, right? Majority of workers are not in unions. We've got to pay attention to those people on their terms, if we're true to labor historian methods, right? Not allowing agency when workers are doing what we want them to do by joining unions, and then saying when they don't, oh, it's because they don't have any agency. That's not convincing to me. So that's one point. The other point is paying more attention to the AFL. So the 30s and 40s, even 50s to some extent, labor historians like to focus on the CIO, understandably. It's the most dynamic organizing force of the time. It's the most progressive force at the time. But the AFL is always at least double the size of the CIO in the 1930s, right? It's growing too. And it's growing on much different terms than the CIO's growing. And so for this story in the tri-state district, the AFL plays a very dastardly role of always trying to, the AFL's also trying to reach out to these miners, like the Western Federation of Miners is, but often in competition with the Western Federation of Miners and in devious ways, trying to offer a more conservative form of unionism to short circuit the more radical Western Federation. And then in the 1930s, it gets even more devious when the AFL charters a company union that had been formed to blunt a mine mill organizing campaign that had led to a strike in 1935. It's a fairly detailed story. But the AFL moves in and takes in this company union. And the miners, to great extent, don't really care, right? The majority don't care because it gives them access to work. It plays on those longer traditions of loyalty to company, of loyalty to your immediate boss, of of special terms as a loyal white man, that whole history of strike breaking, it plays on all of that. But the point is that workers outside of the labor movement, white working class workers, white workers outside of the labor movement, white working class conservatives, have an effect of pulling conservative elements of the labor movement to the right. And that's particularly the case in the IFL and the AFL, who are using them to try to outmaneuver the CIO, and particularly Mine Mill. They're doing this elsewhere too. It's not just this district. It's everywhere in the late 1930s. That I would argue works to a large extent. By 1955, when we get to merger, the AFL-CIO is a lot more like the AFL in the late 1930s than it is the CIO in the late 1930s. And so, I want us to keep our eyes on that dynamic. So it's about who's joining unions, who's joining not, but also what kind of unions are they joining? What are those unions doing? And who are they excluding?
Well, and the last question I have to kind of build on this is that, you know, one thing we see in contemporary discourse is whether you're talking about kind of activists or even frustrated, frustrated liberals who look at white working class people voting for the Republican Party and say, you know, that the classic sort of question of, you know, why aren't these workers voting their interests? And I think that your book suggests a lot about how to answer that question. So I was wondering if you would care to address the entire, you know, however you feel about that, whether it's the entire idea of what the interests of workers actually are or whatever.
That's a big one, Eric. my basic take is that we need to reevaluate what we think their interests are, right? That their interests are not automatically our interests. They may be acting against our interests, but we need to at least consider that they're acting for their own interests, at least how they perceive them, and to take that much more seriously. Which I think we are, I hope, because it's doing extraordinary damage. I don't know if there's a solution. That's where I have a hard time with this, with my book. It's a very ultimately sad book that I found profoundly sad to work on and write, because every time there's an attempt by progressive union members to try to reach these miners, to try to convince them to see things differently, it fails. And the only attempts that ever work are the most conservative attempts that continue to respect commitments to white supremacy, nativist nationalism, rough masculinity, and capitalism, frankly. I don't know how to get out of that trap. That the subjects in my book never get out of that trap.
Well, I think that, I totally agree with you. I think that, I also think that this whole idea of voting their interests is a projection, right? That they are voting their interests, right? They get to decide what their own interests are, but also what do you do with that? Now, once you understand that, what do you do with that in terms of, say, people voting for Trump and or whatever it may be? If anybody had the answer to that, they'd be the most well-paid political consultant ever, because it would change America. But there are no answers, really.
Whoever came up with the concept of the Buddy Garrity voter, you aware of this?
Sure.
From Friday Night Lights.
Yeah.
Buddy Garrity rings a lot of bells with me based on this book. And so I think if people are looking for a way to imagine what an updated version of a tri-state miner looks like, in, 2005 or whatever, it might be someone like Buddy Garrity, right? Or, a owner operator truck driver, or a small independent building contractor, there's this economic realm where these ideas of entrepreneurial possibility continue to resonate with people and attract people. Maybe that's changing now with our current pandemic. as, you know, radical disruption done to those systems, but who knows?
Yeah. Who knows is always the best way to end one of these podcasts.
General, some future historian will get the lovely task of sorting this one out.
Exactly. If we tried, we'd end up just being wrong. The good thing about historians, we know we're wrong about the projecting the future. I wanted to thank you, Jared, very much. Once again, this has been a conversation with Jared Roll, University of Mississippi, about his new book, Poor Man's Fortune: White Working Class Conservatism in American Metal Mining, 1850 to 1950, published by the University of North Carolina Press earlier this year. Jared, thank you so much.
Thank you, Eric. It's been a pleasure. Bye.
Thank you again for listening to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. We would like to thank Elizabeth Nelson of The Paranoid Style for supplying the music necessary to make this podcast possible. You can find this track and the rest of The Paranoid Style's catalog anywhere you can find quality music. If you would like to support the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast or any other aspect of the Lawyers, Guns, and Money project, please visit us at www.patreon.com/lawyersgunsandmoney or donate through the PayPal link on the main website. Thank you again,